Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
And welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Daniel Wilson. Will be telling us a little bit about his polio work. So tell me a little bit about Post Polio Health International.
Okay, Post Polio Health International has been around in one form or another since the late 1950s. It was started by a woman named Ginny Laurie, who was a volunteer in a polio ward in Ohio. And started a newsletter to keep polio patients who were discharged and went home in contact with their friends who were still in rehabilitation. It evolved over the years into a networking organization. Eventually she moved to St. Louis, so the organization moved to St. Louis. And they began publishing a newsletter, which came out several times a year, or at least once a year, that had a lot of information about living with the late effects of polio. People talked about their own experiences. They had information on research, on medical advances. And then in 1979, one of the leaders sent in a letter saying that he was experiencing these weird new weakness and muscle fatigue and like he became more disabled. And his doctors couldn't help them explain what was happening. And so Ginny, with the help of some physicians, began to explore this new phenomenon. Other survivors chimed in and saying they were having similar problems. They eventually organized a conference in Chicago in 1981, I believe, that brought together polio survivors, doctors who were treating polio survivors, to talk about this new phenomenon, which eventually became known as post-polio syndrome. They organized several other conferences in the 1980s. Clinicians began to get on board and to recognize that this was a real phenomenon, not in people's heads. And they helped give post-polio syndrome a reality, to make it a medical reality.
So
the PHI has had now, since 1981, I think we've had 14 conferences. And I think they're unique, Cam, in the sense that they bring together polio survivors, physicians, and researchers, all talking to one another. So on a panel, you're likely to have a doctor, a scientist, a polio survivor, to And so, unlike purely scientific conferences, these involve the patients, the survivors as well.
So, for those who might not be as familiar with the effects of post-polio syndrome, could you tell me a little about that?
Okay. Post-polio syndrome tends to emerge 25 to 30 years after somebody has recovered from the initial attack of polio. So I had polio in 1955. My first symptom showed up in 1987. And what it is you begin to experience increased muscle weakness, fatigue, sometimes confusion, a variety of symptoms. And so people, for example, who might have been using braces and crutches find that they need to go back to using a wheelchair. People who never had to have breathing assistance or who had an iron lung but have been out of it for 20 years find they need to go back on a ventilator, at least part-time. The theory is that it's partly overwork, that polio survivors are overusing whatever muscles were left, and they get worn out faster than they would otherwise because they're overworked.
So,
go ahead.
So, are there any treatments available for post-polio?
There are no specific treatments for post-polio. Many polio survivors go to see physiatrists who are rehabilitation doctors. There's some exercises that can be done. And people can be using, I use a ventilator at night, for example, and oxygen during the day or a BiPAP during the day. I was having a lot of leg pain on my right leg, and I got a brace, and so I can now walk with a lot less pain. So there are things like that that can mitigate the effects, but there are no treatments that can cure the ailments of post-polio syndrome.
So what message would you send to the community about the need for awareness of this condition?
Well, I think that if you have polio or if you know somebody who had polio, you need to be aware of your body. If your body is changing in ways that leave you more disabled, you need to try to see a physiatrist, to try to see a doctor, hopefully, who knows something about post-polio syndrome. I would say join Post-Polio Health International. We're a membership organization, and we're dependent upon our members to support the organization as well as to share the information that they have, to encourage other polio survivors. That really is a self-help organization. And those are the sorts of things that you can do. And you're not helpless. As I said, post-polio syndrome can't be cured, but a good physician can do a lot to mitigate the effects that you're feeling.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are affected by post-polio?
Well, in the United States, there are probably today 250,000 polio survivors. We're a dying breed because, fortunately, there's no more polio. And probably maybe 50-60% of those will experience some symptoms of post-polio syndrome. Not everybody who had polio develops post-polio syndrome. So, you know, I would say just a rough estimate in the United States, 100,000 plus. I know in Canada, for example, and we have about 60 Canadian members in Post-Polio Health International, that Polio Canada has been trying to raise awareness and develop programs for post-polio syndrome. for Canadian polio survivors.
Right, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on
You're
the
welcome.
Line. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Mona Mucher about Access Pro Bono's mental health program. So tell me a little bit about Access Pro Bono's mental health work.
Yeah, so we have a mental health program in which we provide up to 30 minutes of legal advice over the telephone to either detainees who are detained under the Mental Health Act or to their family and friends who are seeking advice on either their own behalf or on behalf of their family members who are detained. So that's what the program is currently. But there was a time where we provided representation, and that this is going back probably to 2014, but the program has evolved since then to only telephone legal advice. And that's because there's another organization in BC which has the funding to provide representation. And then when I say representation, that's for mental health review panel hearings. Those are the hearings that determine if a person should be detained further in a detention center or hospital or if they should be released. So we don't provide representation for that, but we provide a lot of substantive advice, and that includes explaining legal procedure and how to apply for a review panel hearing and how to represent themselves.
So how do you go about reaching out to those who might need your services?
Yeah. So initially when this program began a few years back, we had a lot of flyers go out to the hospitals so that they would have our information, and many of them still do have it. And they have, I believe they've got a special form or flyer in most of the large hospitals in the BC area that have our information for legal advice clinics. And then they have the other organization that does a representation. So they have their information as well. And I believe that there are a lot of nurses out there who also will tell the patients their rights when they're detained, and they tell them about Access Pro Bono. So they're able to find us, and they find us online, or sometimes our contact information is given to them directly. That's usually how we get our calls and our email inquiries from people who are detained.
So what are some of the common barriers facing someone with a mental health concern who has been detained?
So I feel like some of the common barriers they have is Well, number one is sometimes they don't even have access to a phone or internet, so that can make it really difficult for them to find us. And sometimes we have a difficult time calling them back if they're able to leave a message, because sometimes their telephone privileges are revoked by them. And even if some nurses point them to us, they still need to have access to an email, internet, or phone to be able to contact us. And we've also had to deal with some difficult hospital admin and nurses that just don't give the phone to patients, and we have to remind them of patients' rights and how they are violating that right now by not allowing them to speak to their lawyer.
So how do you go about getting around these challenges?
Well, we stay persistent. We keep trying. We keep trying either to book their appointment, and then we have administrative legal interns who are the ones who book, and then sometimes lawyers, when it's their appointment time, they will keep trying as well to get a hold of them. And if we're not able to get a hold of them, we'll book them in again. There's no cap; they can call back as many times as they want to. So we've never had anyone that we were not able to reach. It's just a matter of time.
So, in your time with Access Pro Bono's mental health work, is there any success story that stands out for you?
I don't know if there's any particular success story, but I feel like helping clients get discharged is definitely our greatest success. We try our best to assist them in any way that we can, and it feels great when we call them back and they're no longer there at the hospital. So that's a success, and that happens. And it's great when it happens. Sometimes it doesn't happen, but we help them over and over again. Each time they need advice or they have another hearing coming up, we tell them how to represent themselves, which forms to fill out, what the legal test is that they have to meet, what arguments they can make, what evidence they can present to best represent themselves in their hearing. Sometimes, and I do these clinics as well, some of the patients, they don't even want advice. They just want to be heard. And lending an ear is sometimes all I have to do. And it feels really nice to just be there for someone. And sometimes all they want is some practical advice from me. And I feel like these are small successes, and you can tell how appreciative they are. And it feels really nice every time I do it.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for this work and to provide supports for those with mental health concerns who have been detained, what would you tell them?
I would tell them to please spread the word that we are here. I think them knowing that we're here and what their rights are is, the most important thing, that they're not alone. They may be detained, but their friends and families should know that we're here as well. We're here to help them as well. They can call us and we can explain everything to them, including their own rights as family and friends of detainees. As long as they qualify as a low or modest income individual, we can assist them. There's absolutely no limits on appointments. You can call back over and over to speak to a lawyer, and we'll book you in every time. I want everybody to take advantage of this free resource in the community. And if it's a complicated problem that's kind of beyond the review panel hearing, meaning it's something that needs to be appealed to Supreme Court, we have a different program that's called the Roster Program, and we'll try to refer you to that internally so that we can find a lawyer to actually represent you. So there's so much work that we can do, not just at the review panel hearing for detainees, but even further if it needs to go to court. So we're here, and if you could spread the word to everyone that you know that may need our assistance, that would be great.
So what are the next steps forward in your work?
Next steps forward would just be continue doing what we're doing, hoping to spread the word and reaching out as much as we can. I've recently noticed a decline in calls, so that makes me really happy. There was an increase during COVID. When the lockdown was happening, it got a little hectic, for sure. But I think things have gotten better as time has unfolded, as we've approached fall. We're just going to continue doing our best to assist and try to get everybody the legal assistance that they can.
So where can listeners go about finding more information about the work you do?
Yeah, so they can find us online. We have our website up, so they can look us up at Access Pro Bono Society of BC Online. And then we're also on social media. We've got Facebook, we have Instagram, we also have LinkedIn. So we post publicly as well. And every now and then we're posting about our programs that we have and what our programs do and who they assist. So that's we do a lot of social media advertisement on our own as well. So if anybody needs to get a hold of us, they can find us online. They can our website has special links in which you can literally sign up or send a message if you need assistance. Every program has its own little page, so you can go to the mental health program and you can watch a video. There's a video there that explains the program, and then if you need to kind of go through kiosk, you can go in and fill out some information to do an intake, and somebody will reach out to you. And then, of course, if you want to reach out to us through social media, you can do that as well.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Green Bean Cafe is a hybrid space for artists, academics, and any others looking for a safe and open atmosphere to hang out, meet up, or do work. We offer a full food and drink menu with daily specials. And with a wide range of weekly events, the Green Bean Cafe is sure to fill the void. The Green Bean Cafe, supporting Pockets Full of Change since 2009. Located at 2320 Wyandotte Street West. Find us online at greenbeancoffee.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Mona Mucher told us a little bit about Access Pro Bono's mental health program
And Daniel Wilson told us a little bit about post-polio.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Anthony Frazina from the OD Coalition. So tell me a little bit about the coalition.
So I joined the coalition a few years ago under Sherry Caldwell's leadership. It's about bringing awareness to the importance of accessibility and inclusion and the lack of funding that goes along with it and the lack of appreciation and understanding support of the support towards people with disabilities.
So what are some of the most common barriers, aside from lack of funding, the things that can be created by this and those that work hand in hand with it?
The barriers stem from a lack of fundamental and systemic opportunities that communities across Ontario can bring. It comes with more education and more opportunities to bring about that culture change, which is really direly needed right now.
So, can you give me an overview of the coalition's specific work?
The coalition is regarding the importance of access to funding, access to the importance of sending the message of the fact that people with disabilities, which is the largest minority group, that we're people first, and we really are focused on that, and we're really focused on bringing awareness to bridging the gap to inclusion and what that looks like.
So how do you spread the word about this work?
Sorry?
So how do you spread the word about the work you're doing?
A lot of it is through sources like yourself, through social media is our big platform, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Now, and it's just important about getting people on board, building what I refer to as allyships. You don't necessarily need to be directly involved with the disability community, but for me, it's about bringing the allies together and uniting in a collective front to support inclusion. And that really is about creating a collective prosperity.
So, one could look at it as, in some way, everyone's affected by disability, so getting involved with this is just a step that everyone should take, whether for their own peace of mind or for friend, family. We all have that someone.
In some way, shape, or form, your disability is the only demographic that anybody could enter at any time, whether it be a temporary or permanent situation. Not that I'm wanting that to happen to anybody, but that could happen at some point, whether disability is affected at birth or over time.
So, are there any challenges in building these community connections and these allies, as you say?
I think just the collective and getting in people involved and getting people to understand the challenges and being cognizant of the fact that we're like I said, we're people too, and that we really do need to work collectively together to build that united front so that we can all collectively prosper. It's often overlooked and overshadowed by a lot of assumptions-based mindsets because they're not necessarily directly privy to it. But once they see it in action and once they know that they can be an ally to the collective change that is in dire straits right now, that we can all work together and make this happen.
So, in your time with the coalition, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
For me, you know, in terms of success stories, I get, we all work together and we all collectively put our goals together. Now, myself with the coalition has gotten together and created a stand at Queen's Park a couple years ago to ensure that we get certain individuals' attention to regarding the funding, regarding overcoming systemic fundamental barriers to understand that this is important to the quality of life for people with disabilities.
So, if you could send any message to the community about what needs to happen, why people should get involved, what would you say?
My message would be clear. Again, we all need to be collectively involved together. Whether you are a part of the disability community directly or indirectly, or know somebody, or just want to inquire and see what you can do to be an ally, I encourage everybody to get involved, because it takes a village to really prosper when it comes to accessibility and inclusion. And working together, building relationships, building this village together, we can all benefit from.
So, what are the next steps for you and the coalition?
Just continue to do what we're doing. Like, we're just continually getting the message out. We're promoting the success stories of a lot of our kids in the community. We're promoting a lot of the importance of what it takes to be an ally, what it takes to be included in the community, and what it takes to continually grow the importance of accessibility and inclusion.
So, how can people go about finding out more information about the coalition?
So they can go to ODC Coalition on Facebook. The connection there, her name is Sherry Caldwell, and she's our shining star behind the coalition.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, thank you.
Of course.
My friends, I think one of the most critical things covered in today's show was the idea of having legal supports and advice for those with mental health concerns. Sometimes in society, we hear the term mental health concern. We immediately jump to an image of someone who's disenfranchised, incoherent, what have you. Many cases, not the case. They are someone as equal and as entitled to consideration as anyone else in society. They're someone we should be looking to support in whatever way possible. The fact is, no matter how a person's brain processes things, or how they move, how they see, how they think, how they hear, we're all part of this great tapestry of life. And there is nothing that can ever convince me that someone should be excluded or overlooked in any way simply because they find themselves with any sort of disability. A mental health concern isn't something that's as easy to understand as something we can immediately look at and process. A lot of times there aren't obvious outward visible signs, but it's still something we must take into consideration. We must recognize it's not coming from a malicious place or a place where someone is beyond hope. This is just something that we can work with, something we can provide support for. If we can keep an open mind, then we're overcoming the biggest disability of all, which is to say, bias. But the truth is, we all need that someone and that moment of support in our lives, someone to see beyond the surface, to recognize our needs and our potential. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.